This is the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Discourse on Loving Kindness, and this is found in the collection of teachings called the Sutta Nipata. One who is skilled in the good and who wishes to attain that state of calm, nirvana, should act thus. One should be sincere to oneself, upright and conscientious, of soft speech, gentle and not proud. Contented, living simply, peaceful and unburdened, with senses calmed, prudent, modest, and without showing anxiety for support. One should not commit any slight wrong on account of which wise men might censure one. May all beings be happy and secure, may their hearts be wholesome. Whatever living beings there may be, those mentally feeble or strong, physically long, stout or medium, short, small or large, those seen or unseen, dwelling far or near, those who are born and those who are to be born, may all beings, without exception, be happy-minded. Let none deceive another, nor despise any person whatsoever in any place. In anger or ill will, let one not wish any harm to another. Just as a mother would protect her only child at the risk of her own life, even so let one cultivate a boundless heart towards all beings. Let thoughts of infinite love pervade the whole world, above, below, and around, without any obstruction, without any hatred, without any enmity. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, as long as one is awake, this mindfulness should be developed. This, the wise say, is the highest conduct here. Not embracing false views, virtuous and endowed with insight, giving up attachment to sense desires, indeed, such a person does not come again for repeated becoming, for rebirth.
I'd like to invite you to respond to this.
Thank you. Let me first say what a very great privilege it is to be invited to a conversation this afternoon. I'm deeply grateful for the opportunity to speak with you, to listen and to share. I don't conceive this afternoon's business to be a matter of argument between two systems. I want to speak about what it is in these texts that speaks to us, whether Buddhists or Christians, and to see where these words find their echo and their home in us. And I have two responses to share with you on the Metta Sutta. The first is to pick up the word which comes towards the end, which is mindfulness. In our Christian tradition, and especially in the Eastern Christian tradition, people speak of wakefulness. The Greek word nepsis is often used for this. The person who seeks wisdom and who seeks a homecoming from the truth is the person who seeks to be woken up. And it's interesting that one of the most ancient Christian hymns, which we read in Christian scripture, begins with the words, "Awake, sleeper, rise from the dead, Christ will give you light." And thinkers in the Eastern Christian tradition have also noticed that in the story of Jesus' transfiguration, as recorded in the Gospels, there's a description of the disciples falling asleep. And when they awoke, they saw Jesus only. So that imagery of wakefulness or watchfulness is very deeply ingrained in the Christian understanding of living, meditating, worshipping. And it is a wakefulness, a watchfulness, which is indeed to be applied whether standing, walking, sitting, or lying down. As long as one is awake, this mindfulness should be developed. And some would say even when we are asleep, this mindfulness should be developed, because there is a long tradition, and I'd be interested to hear what echoes this has in your traditions, of guarding one's thoughts even while asleep in the Eastern Christian world. That is, if you are awake and watchful during your waking hours, you will in some sense be awake while you're asleep. As even the verse of an Anglican hymn of the 17th century, which speaks of this, but that's perhaps another story. And that wakefulness is in part the openness to clear vision, and it's in part, therefore, an openness to clear vision about oneself, which is why we speak not only of wakefulness, but of watchfulness, vigilance. That is the scrutiny, the questioning of what arises within. The Christian traditions assume that what arises when we seek to contemplate God is going to be confused, dark, diverse, and that if we do not examine it and scrutinize it, the confusion and the darkness dictate our actions and dictate how we see one another. One of the great writers of the early church, Evagrius, writing in the 4th century, speaks of the different kinds of knowing that there may be in the human mind. He says there is a diabolical knowing which seeks to know what is around only insofar as it serves my passions and my desires. There is an angelic knowing which penetrates immediately to the truth, the inner truth of things. And there is a human knowing in which these things are constantly mixed together and need always to be discerned and worked upon. To be watchful, nyptikos in Greek, to be awake, is to be alert to the ways in which our human knowing slides towards the diabolical and seeks, therefore, to bring everything within the scope of what serves myself and my desires at any moment. And in constantly questioning and opening up to God, we seek something more like angelic knowledge, in which when we see what is around us and who is around us, we are gifted with the penetration that takes us into the heart of what is there, and in that openness are able to serve and to love. And so I move to the second point that echoes in this text. Just as a mother would protect her only child at the risk of her own life, even so let one cultivate a boundless heart towards all beings. Let thoughts of infinite love pervade the whole world, above, below, and around, without any obstruction, without any hatred, without any enmity. What is universal love? It cannot be a universal feeling of affection. It cannot be that for all things and all people we simply feel friendly. It is a more unconditional matter than that, because if it's a matter of feeling friendly, some things make us feel friendly, some people make us feel friendly, and some definitely don't make us feel friendly. And therefore, universal love can't depend on that. And one of our teachers in the 7th century, St. Maximus, speaks of how what we love in others as Christians is simply their nature. What we love is what is there. We don't ask, does it make us feel friendly? Does it make us feel better? we embrace what is there, because that is what comes from the hand of God or from the mouth of God. It is St. Maximus who says that each thing and each person in the world is a word, an intelligible utterance of the transcendent God. And what we love is that transcendent utterance. Now, there is an easy mistake to be made about that, which is that we never love any particular people at all, and that we just go around with a general feeling of affirmation towards everything. As has often been said, I am a great lover of humanity, it is human beings I have difficulty with. I don't believe that that is what St. Maximus is teaching us. He is saying that how we welcome, affirm, serve, and nourish all those around us must not depend on whether they please us or not. That is to slither towards diabolical knowledge, to say, this is conditional on whether you are serving my need. So I seek to have that wisdom and love towards the other, which is universal and unconditional, because whatever my feelings, I'm not going to be deflected, turned aside from that love, simply because someone has spoken harshly to me, someone is not cooperating with me, someone's face or voice doesn't please me, they are strangers of one sort and another, on the contrary. And the paradox is that in such love, we truly can love everyone in their particularity, because there is no particularity that will stop that love. Therefore, we can affirm the difference, the diversity of all, and say, yes, we love all in their diversity. And some of our teachers, I think especially here, of another writer of the 7th, 8th century, St. Isaac the Syrian, some of our teachers speak of how, in such a condition, we love not only other human beings and animate beings and sentient beings, we love the entire creation. We even love, says St. Isaac, we even love the demons. Because while the demons are out to make our lives difficult, we are not out to make their lives difficult. They exist, and so we are commanded, in some sense, to embrace them. Not to affirm them and pat them on the backs and say, get on with your job, but to welcome their being and to respond accordingly. And so, as I hear this text, those are the echoes that come into my mind from our own tradition. Mindfulness in terms of being awake, and that watchfulness and wakefulness being for us the way in which we keep guard against that rising up in us of self-directed, diabolical knowing and seeing, which shrinks the world to the scale of what I can see and use. And instead of that, in the silence and the letting go of our contemplation, we seek the word, the self-utterance of God, coming alive in us, which allows us true sight, truthful vision of the other, universal love, a love without condition, that is able to embrace all the diversity that the world may bring to us. And behind all this lies, finally, that very strong Christian tradition, which alas has been very much forgotten in modern Christianity and in Western Christianity, the tradition of reflecting on what we call apatheia. Not apathy, quite the opposite. but that state in which we're delivered from slavery to the instincts. Not that our instincts are evil, but that if they shape all our reactions to one another, we shall be prisoners of illusion and sin. Apatheia is that state in which we understand we must not be, again in the words of the New Testament, blown about by every wind that comes, but established in the unconditional act of divine love. We are rooted in that, rooted and grounded in that love. It is when we allow ourselves to be turned this way and that by the arising of instinctual desire taking over our minds, clouding our wakefulness, sending us to sleep again, then we are in trouble. So the person who lives in apatheia is indeed someone who is contented, living simply, peaceful and unburdened, with senses calmed. Senses calmed, meaning for many in our tradition, having our senses truly themselves woken up, simply to see and to receive what is there. Calm in the sense that our senses are now working as they should. Not greedy for sensation, greedy for stimulus, but always truthful and open in receiving what is there. I speak out of an unfathomable depth of ignorance of how these things truly are, knowing only that I've seen it in those who have been my teachers and examples, but I offer that as a first response to this text.
Thank you so much. Ajahn Amaro, I would like to invite you to respond.
Well, Your Grace, I was very much looking forward to hearing what you might have to say. Even before you said it, it was an intriguing idea. And listening to your words and your reflections, I was very impressed. And I can see there's a great deal of room for rich dialogue and also drawing upon each other's traditions, and particularly the uses of different words over the many centuries that articulate these particular qualities, say like apatheia, as you mentioned, and also the nepsis, forgive my incorrect pronunciation. So in terms of responding to some of the things that you said, I thought I'd start talking about metta, or loving kindness. So many of the things that you commented on were extraordinarily resonant and familiar to me in my own training and practice. One of the aspects of metta, when we hear these initial words, or they talk about a very beautiful or bright aspiration, and so that it can seem to be, well, here is what the perfect person does, this is how they think, this is how they feel, okay, how can I then just be that, how can I accommodate that? And so we can often pick up those ideals, those spiritual forms, and not understanding, not really seeing our own nature clearly, in a sense, climbing over our own particular obstructions and difficulties and trying to mimic or to simply replicate the behaviours that are good. And then in the process of that, often creating more tension and difficulty and obstruction within ourselves. We don't recognise our own spiritual obstructions and confusions, and all of those are diabolic. the diabolic element of the that Evagrius was highlighting. So one of the way, oftentimes when we use the translation for metta, like loving kindness, and again it was also picking up on what you said about the other Christian theologians, Maximus and Saint Isaac the Syrian, how that when we talk about love, it's not talking about affection. And in Buddhist practice, we would talk in exactly the same way, that metta doesn't mean liking everything. And I notice you use that word, not having affection for everyone. So in a similar way, we wouldn't consider that to have metta for everyone means that you're trying to like everyone. Because as my own teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, would often point out, there are many things in life which are not likable. You know, that, and to try and assume we've got to have an attitude which causes us to like the unlikable, like liking pain in our body, or liking the loss of a loved one, or liking an economic or a social crisis. You know, you can't like those. But what metta means essentially is learning how to have a radical acceptance for the actuality of those qualities as part of the natural world, the natural order of things. And I was so touched. I mean, there were some moments where I was thinking you were quoting some familiar teachers of mine in the Buddhist tradition, whereby you're learning how not to ignore those painful or difficult states, but rather to have a quality of accommodation, acceptance, and recognizing these two belong. You know, selfishness, violence, laziness, cruelty, they're not beautiful. You're not praising those qualities as being wonderful and good, but you're recognizing these are part of nature. These are part of the natural order. And so in the Metta Sutta, when it talks about having loving kindness towards all beings, whether they're long or short, tall or small, etc., etc., this isn't just talking about the dimensions of our bodies. It's also talking about the inner beings, the inner qualities of our own minds, our own bright and beautiful qualities, and then our own kind of dark and shady, uncomfortable, selfish qualities. So to have metta is to be ready to receive those and know those, and on that basis of reception and the basis of respectfulness, then I like that phrase of yours, non-particularity or no particularity towards those. Then we can respond to those states of mind, those qualities within ourselves, in an unbiased way, so that if we see something as unwholesome or obstructive, then we train ourselves not to follow it. If we see something as beneficial and beautiful, we train ourselves to follow it. Maybe the other little point to pick up on when you're talking about those demons is another very commonly recited verse that was composed in Thailand in the 19th century, which is called The Sharing of Blessings or The Sharing of Merit. And there's a passage in there where you are where you say, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, you know, friendly, indifferent or hostile, the highest gods and the evil forces. So you're consciously sharing the good karma of your life with the evil influences of the world, the demons. You're literally embracing the demons. You're learning to share the goodness of your life in exactly the same phraseology, we would say, not because you're glad about what they're doing, but because more hatred is only going to make it worse, and that by embracing them, then you are embracing that quality of their own inner purity, their own intrinsic goodness. I forget exactly how your grace phrased that in terms of the fundamental internal quality. Maybe you could remind me later on as we discuss this, but it was in a sense, addressing that in terms of Buddhist philosophy, there is no such thing as an absolute evil. So that you can't have a being which is entirely evil, but more that there are beings, so we all fundamentally have the same nature, but some of us are more deluded than others, and some of us are more prone to following those deluded states, and others are prone to following more awakened and illumined states. Another of the reflections, I was interested that you started off with the mindfulness element, and also I was taking note of these Greek words, nepsis and niptikos. And it also particularly reminded me of, and also it's interesting how with this this teaching, the Karaniya Metta Sutta, how it brings together the qualities of loving kindness. So it's not just an aspiration, but it's also talking about that quality of mindfulness, and also a letting go. Again, as a very familiar phrase to us in Buddhist practice. And that, in a way, the means whereby to actualize these qualities of love in an unconditional and unbiased manner is through the establishment of mindfulness. That's a substantial part of it. I was reminded in particular of verses from the Dhammapada, another of the key frequently recited and much used, a very influential scripture in the Theravada. I think it's the 20th and 21st verses of the Dhammapada say, "Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the path to death. The mindful never die. The heedless are as if dead already." A bit blunt. but I was appreciating also that 17th century hymn, you know, "Awake, sleeper, rise from the dead." Like, wake up, guys! that the Buddha is being equally blunt. And also similarly that image of when we are living caught up in our confusions, say our attention taken with our personal obsessions, our own fears and desires and selfish, self-centered tendencies, then we are effectively not just asleep but dead. And this is the languaging that the Buddha uses, that the heedless are as if dead already. And it's also interesting to say the mindful never die. And in that, I thought to also just pick out the last four lines of the Metta Sutta. So it says, "Not embracing false views, virtuous and endowed with insight, giving up attachment to sense desires. Indeed, such a person does not come again for repeated becoming, for rebirth." So also the English translation here is a little bit clunky, but I think we all can follow that well enough. To me, it's also interesting, and it struck me when years ago we started reciting the Metta Sutta rather than just in Pali, in English as well, that there was a change of gear that happens from the theme that you're developing through the first 90% of the sutta, but the last four lines, then there's a shift that is being made in that. And so, just as I said before, you have this whole laying out of this is how a mind with the quality of love filling it is it acts. Then the way you do it is through being mindful. And in this last passage here, not embracing false views and so forth, when it talks about not coming to rebirth or not being born again, this doesn't mean a sort of biological rebirth. It's not just talking about past lives and future lives, but it's the more psychological rebirth, being born into our habits, being born into our compulsions, being born into our preferences and opinions. And so that being free from rebirth and not being born again doesn't mean this life is the last one and no more necessarily, but it can more significantly and directly on a day-to-day, moment-by-moment basis mean freeing the heart from its addictions and compulsions and habits and blind preferences. So, from that point, I'll finish my reflections and open things up for.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
That's okay.